levies, but you need to come and report to us and tell us what's happening so that we can see whether this is actually assisting our people in South Africa and is going the right direction that the police of South Africa want us to go. So members, we have the Council for Medical Aid Scheme, which is a regulator, and that giving us their annual report. I'm going to be giving over to them. But before we go to that, Ufuyola's always tells me that even if they know you, but you need to tell them who you are. And then we can move forward. So we'll start with Dube.
Morning, Member Dube. My name is Molebogeng Grace Dube, member of the Portfolio Committee.
Morning. My name is Rebecca Makosha Motsepe, member of this committee. Thank you. Morosi Sakhalisiso, a member of the committee.
Honorable Mwesu, we said we're not going to have tea today, but there are eats outside, so we're not going to have a formal tea, but people, if they want to have tea, they can move out and come back, because we want to make sure that by 12 o'clock we're out of this room. Since it's a Friday, we're hoping that you'll agree with us with that. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. Just for comments, members, I'm not sure whether you've heard this, but I heard something that is, it's a little bit worrying, but you must take it to your consequences. You know, we've had a spate of elderly people being raped, the over 85, especially around KZN. You know, I heard something, I don't know whether you've heard it. It is said that those people are being raped because there's a belief that if you are HIV positive and you rape an elderly person, like it happened to the young ones, the kids. So if you rape an elderly person, then your HIV and AIDS will be cured. So that's what is making it to be like that. And I think it's something that we need to take with our communities and make them understand that those myths, we need to forget about those myths. The good thing is that probably the transport strike is going to come to an end. At least we'll have petrol. I'm not sure whether it will come to an end, but it's good news. CMS, we'll give her over to you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, and to the members of the committee. Thank you for having us here today. It behoves me at the outset simply to introduce ourselves to you. My name is Trevor Bailey, and I'm the acting chairperson of the council. The highly skilled team that we have with us this morning is made up of the registrar and the CEO, BC, and Gancho, of course, is very well known to you. We also have with us on the doctor's left, Mr. Daniel Lahusha, who is the chief financial officer of the council. On his left is Teboho Mazia, who is the head of our financial supervision unit. And last but not least, we have sitting at the back Mr. Michael Willey, who is the acting senior manager research. It's often inappropriate to single out particular individuals, but I think that it is worth noting that Mr. Willey has this year had five articles published in international journals. All of them have been peer-reviewed, and that's an astonishing statistic, but I think what it does bring out is the quality of the work and the research that in fact has been conducted by the council. And I think that that's going to come out this morning in the presentations that we're going to make to you. What I would like to do is just spend some time just sketching just providing some background to the CMS and in terms of what we've been doing over the past year before we get into some more of the detail, which will of course no doubt be of great interest to you. The chairperson has already indicated that that there are a range of challenges that are facing our health system. He's already referred to the divide between the rich and the poor. therefore no accident that South Africa's health system is undergoing a much-needed strategic review. Both the public and the private sectors have to be affected by this. And clearly the role of regulators remains crucial in this ever-changing environment. And we're going to show you today that by guiding the medical schemes industry into an unprecedented stability and performance, that the Council for Medical Schemes has continued to support efforts aimed at strengthening the entire health system in our country. Let's begin with the NHI. Council has continued in the past year to support the Department of Health in its efforts to strategically review the entire health system. And it's done so by providing input to the technical subcommittee of the Ministerial Advisory Committee on the proposed national health insurance system. And in this regard, it has submitted a detailed formal document on the NHI policy paper. Turning then to the question of costs, we regulate an industry of 107 billion rand annual turnover. We do so with a budget of 107 million rand. Ever-escalating costs in the industry are being driven by private health hospitals and medical specialists. And this has always been one of our concerns, and this past year has proved no different. This is a worrying trend, particularly given that the increases are often exceeding inflation, in the private health sector. And we believe that this has serious and negative implications for the well-being and sustainability of the entire health system. Council therefore continued to motivate for the establishment of a regulator to oversee the price determination of private health care provision. We at Council believe that a real need exists for a platform where medical schemes and healthcare providers can meet and negotiate prices for the benefit of all, and I underline all, South African health consumers. We believe that private healthcare providers should be regulated, specifically the hospitals and specialists, and the practice where beneficiaries are exposed to unfair billing practices simply has to be addressed. So, at the heart of what we do is to put our beneficiaries first. They're at the core of what we do. We believe that they must get value for their hard-earned money and that they must continue to enjoy protection against unpredictable, undesirable, and potentially catastrophic health events. None of us, even in this room, simply knows what lies around the corner for us in terms of our own health. Beneficiaries and everyone else, of course, is no different. So therefore we believe that no effort should be spared to eradicate all forms of unfair discrimination threatening the well-being of beneficiaries, however long such noble efforts may take all of us here today. Now as you know, the Medical Schemes Act provides a unique legislative framework aimed at providing equitable access to private health care on par with the best of the world. Yes, imperfections do exist. And in this regard, we've continued to engage our minister to ensure that the necessary legislative amendments are considered, especially those meant to strengthen the protection of beneficiaries and to improve the functioning of the entities that a council oversees. A regulator is only as empowered as the enabling legislation. The registrar has previously addressed you on the ongoing deliberations that we are having with the department, and at some point the proposed amendments will clearly be placed before you for your consideration, and obviously we rely on your support as you deliberate those amendments. But now is not the time today to discuss those proposals. So clearly what we have to do is to continue to guide and to work with the industry. We are confident that, and in fact we're going to show you today, that the medical schemes industry of South Africa has never looked better. The financial health and long-term sustainability of medical schemes and businesses affiliated with them remain one of our priorities and must continue to do so. We believe that only well-managed and financially sound medical schemes, empowered and supported by good legislation and a strong regulator, can offer just and adequate protection against ill health and guarantee respect for the constitutional imperative of fair treatment for all. won't today deal with the range of cases that we deal with. That all appears in the report. Certainly what we want to ensure, want to say to you today, that this council is a strong regulator. It doesn't step back from needing to regulate where it needs to do and to be strong where it needs to be. And we want to let you know that we're going to continue to do that. And this has come through if one looks at the mergers, liquidations and curatorships that have in fact taken place in the past year. Now, mergers, liquidations, curatorships, these are the natural and even expected outcomes of a healthy and robust free market economy where both consumers and service providers have their rights and responsibilities. And where the council needs to place schemes under curatorship, or under liquidation for that matter, that should not necessarily be seen as a sign of failure. Rather, it should be seen as a regulator doing what it's legislated to do. So I really want to say to you today that the council's efforts must be acknowledged in contributing to the fact that the medical schemes industry has never been as healthy as it is now. This, of course, does not make it perfect, but it's certainly better than it has been before. And so really what we want to say to you today is that much progress was made in the past year to distinguish and protect medical schemes from commercial health insurance without infringing on the provisions of the Medical Schemes Act when the Minister of Finance published for public comment the draft regulations on the so-called demarcation matter. Council trusts that legislative amendments will enhance efforts aimed at creating an ever fairer environment for of healthcare for South African consumers. Also, at the heart of what we do is our compliance mechanisms. Now, this simply must and always does remain on our regulatory radar, especially when it comes to good governance, which is a pillar of any healthy organisation and industry. In this regard, Council has introduced this year routine inspections into medical schemes. The accreditation standards for managed care organisations are also much improved. In terms of some of the projects that we've been involved in, I'm just going to deal with two amongst many. What we've done is we've tried to be more proactive and an effective regulator. And so therefore we've embarked on projects which will enable us to keep an even closer eye of scrutiny on the industry and to serve it better. So the first such project would be the Composite Risk Index, and the second is the Real-Time Monitoring Project. Now, the real-time monitoring initiative will allow Council to monitor the financial and non-financial indicators of medical schemes in real-time, monthly at first, and daily as the project develops and is perfected. The Composite Risk Index combines different types of data on medical schemes to try and predict which schemes should experience difficulties and take regulatory action before the problem grows too big. So simply what we're saying that we've introduced these projects because we believe that prevention is better than cure. And that in itself, in the event, is a very healthy health maxim. And last but not least, what I would like to just simply address you on is an important matter around the role of the of regulatory bodies and their duty to report. In the past year, we've seen the resolution of a long-standing matter between the council and a medical scheme which alleged that it had been defamed when council reported on the scheme's governance problems in its annual report of 2004 and 2005. And this matter went to the High Court, and the council there lost the matter and was required to pay a certain amount of damages. It is our view to be strong. We then took that matter to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And what the Supreme Court of Appeal has ultimately done is it has confirmed that the Council has the duty and responsibility to report on matters of interest and value to members of the public affected by the behaviour of medical schemes and other entities. This is important because what the Supreme Court of Appeal has done is that it has said to regulatory bodies that you should not not report on matters where you in fact believe that there may have been some form of unlawful action. In fact, you have a duty to report on it. So So clearly that case has also, in fact, therefore set the precedent for the many other regulatory bodies that exist in our republic, that there should be no fear of reporting on matters where, in fact, unlawful behaviour might take place. Finally, what I would like to do, and in fact Professor Peck is not here today, he of course has over the years appeared before you, his term came to an end last year, and he simply did a great job in guiding the council through its initial stages, and in his absence I'd simply just like to pay tribute to the role that he played. We valued his guiding hand, and obviously we wish the Professor good luck in his retirement. Thank you very much. That's all I'm going to say for the moment. Obviously, we know that questions will be forthcoming in due course, and therefore behoves me at this point to present to you the registrar. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and honourable members of the Health Portfolio Committee, Acting Chairperson of Council, and my colleagues from the Office of the Registrar. The presentation today will basically be the one that summarises the annual report that has been circulated, that is before you. The Chairperson has dealt with high-level policy-related matters that informs the mandate of the Council of Medical Schemes. Ours and mine in particular is to deal with the four areas that you have in front of you on the screen. And that is, we will hear today, the areas that talk to legislated mandate of the Council for Medical Schemes. We will highlight the highlights for the CMS, the year under review. We will talk about the overview of the financial results of the Council for Medical Schemes over the period. And lastly, a sketch to you the overview of the medical scheme industry in South Africa, dealing with the financial aspects of that and also the non-financial aspects. The Council for Medical Schemes legislated mandate, Chairperson, talks to the Act that was promulgated in 1998 and the one that is currently in existence. It has 12 years in existence. This Act governs not only the Council, but it governs also the industry. It governs the industry in the form of its composition. And the entities will be the medical aid schemes themselves as we know them, the administrators of the medical schemes, managed healthcare organizations, the healthcare brokers, and the brokerage companies. We do the last one on the brokerage companies in concurrence or co-regulating it with the Financial Services Board. At the heart of this Act is protecting members of the medical aid schemes and their beneficiaries, and regulating the industry as efficiently and effectively as we can, and in so doing, we contribute to the entire health systems that benefit the whole country. How the Act then protects me, my colleagues, the beneficiaries, yourselves, being the representatives of the communities that have put you in Parliament today. We promote the non-discriminatory access to privately funded healthcare in South Africa in keeping and in line with the constitution of the country. The non-discrimination applies in this case even to those who would have chosen to be in the private healthcare industry funded in South Africa. We do this by using the principles of the open enrollment. It is open to everyone who can afford to belong to it. And that is critical to emphasize on that, because at the moment that talks to 60% of the population in South Africa that can afford private healthcare insurance industry. The rest of the 84% then is the one that is the burden of the state. And one of our duties is not to overburden the state by not regulating this industry very well. The second pillar, Chairperson, is the one that talks to community rating. Once an individual belongs to the medical aid scheme, the payments or the this industry. Among other reasons, as I mentioned before, Chair, is that the state and the public services must not be burdened and overburdened. We encourage the active participation of the communities that belong to the medical aid schemes in their entirety, and we investigate and resolve any complaints that come in. Obviously, the resolution of such complaints or even the initiation of investigating them should start with the medical aid schemes first. But if there is no joy in that, the Council for Medical Schemes is there to help. There are highlights during this period of time. Some of these highlights we have in front of us are the highlights that we do not necessarily, as the Council for Medical Schemes, claim as our own or as our success. I think what you have in front of you, Chair, is what the country can claim as a success for itself. It is only in the second slide where I specifically mentioned the areas that we as the Council for Medical Schemes can claim success and be proud of. Here, the country, the national health system, can talk to the NHI about what it is doing going on forward, and that ownership lies within the policymakers. The Medical Schemes Amendment Bill is an area that we're looking to improve, and we're doing so together with the Department of Health, the Minister, and eventually it will end up with the Parliament. The demarcation between medical schemes and health insurance products is an area that the country, the general population of South Africa needs to be aware of and do something about it. Ours is to facilitate and point out to Parliament and all the parties involved what this demarcation between the medical schemes and health insurance actually entails and what it needs and the need for it to be addressed. I've talked briefly about the PMPs, which is one of the pillars of the medical schemes. The determination of the prices in the private healthcare sector is an area that concerns each and every individual. It's an area that the department and the minister in particular have identified to be resolved. It's an area that continues to talk to the cost of delivering healthcare service. For us as the CMS, we're proud to say that during this period, we had to speak openly about the interest and the rights of the members, and we have done this and secured a Supreme Court of Appeal judgment in this regard. That is just one example of the scheme that was cited in that case. We have done the inspections and the investigations, as the Chairperson has mentioned before me, and those are just the two examples that are currently taking place. But the process that led to the conclusion of these inspections and investigations started even before the period under review. We have had what is called a risk equalization fund before as a principle to equalize the risk that all the schemes, all 97 of them as we speak right now, but that process has not found much favor within the health policy making institutions. We then innovatively, as the Council for Medical Schemes, came up with what we call RETEP, Risk Equalization Technical Advisory Panel, which is now an industry technical advisory panel. It's a technical terminology. We can explain and go into detail about that as we go on, but it shows the innovation. It shows the passion that this institution that we represent today wants to do, that there is sustainability in the medical aid industry for as long as it is in existence. We also have, during this period of time, made medical scheme rule amendments and in form of regulations in particular that would guide on the contribution increases, communicate with the industry in various forms, and ask and inform it and direct it what it should do. We have observed trends in registered contribution increases. Each year we have to guide the schemes and inform them what should be the increase year on year. During the same period, Chairperson, there's been an improvement in the regulatory effectiveness. We see this in the from the information we get from the routine inspection of medical schemes. We see this in the improved accreditation standards that we have done. We have done this by introducing the real-time monitoring of the industry so that we can have our finger on the pulse in this industry all the time by real-time monitoring. We've got the composite risk index that we continue to develop to make sure that the risk that the schemes and therefore the risk that members and beneficiaries might be exposed to is mitigated for in time. The Auditor General has, and we'll hear a bit more about this when the CFO from the office talks about that. The Auditor General has, for the 12th time, given us an unqualified Chair, this is in fact not only a clean record that we received from the Auditor General, it is the cleanest that we have had. And this is taking place at a time when many of the public institutions are qualified and they have appeared before the portfolio committees in this informing you what is the difficulty there. You will not find this with the Council for Medical Schemes, with the team that I lead. You will not find this in the Council that is led by the chairperson of the Council for Medical Schemes. We continue and we intend to continue on this path going on forward in many years to come. Our budget, as you know, mainly comes from the levies charged to medical schemes per member per year, which means any family that belongs to a medical aid scheme, meager amount, less than 24 rand a year per family, is going to fund and to finance this institution. That gives us, as we speak right now, 107 million rand in an industry that is 107 billion rand. What does it cost the members out there? Less than 25 rand per family a year. We have to look into this. If we can improve on that, as we continue to request that we do so, we will see more and more successes in the regulation of this industry. Our budget comes from that, to those levies, minor, meager amounts from accreditation fees, registration fees of those medical schemes and medical and managed care organizations that belong that registered with the Council for Medical Schemes. We received 94 million rand in the period under review to regulate this industry that I just mentioned. It is now worth 107 million rand. The nature and extent of litigation against the registrar, the council, remains unpredictable. We cannot tell who is going to litigate against the regulator. The council's expenditure on legal fees, therefore, members of parliament will be interested, amounted during the period under review to 10 million rand in the financial year under review, like I said. By comparison, medical schemes spend during that period a total of 50.5 million rand on legal fees, including litigation. This is only a few number of medical aid schemes, not all of the 97 schemes that we have. Six schemes who appealed against decisions of the registrar and the council in the year under review spent 27 million rand on legal fees, including litigation. It just goes to show. Just to put it in a pictorial form for you to have a picture, members of parliament, is that comparative spend on legal fees, the blue indicates the 27 million rand spent by only six medical schemes in legal fees, whilst the council spent only 10.4 million rand. And we've been successful. All our cases up to date, some drag and take a long time, and therefore we cannot report to you, even though we handled them during the period under review, we couldn't tell how when they will end. Some take as long as 6 years. And it is during then this period, Chairperson, that I want to say, as I am about to conclude, and say that one of the Council's key responsibilities is obviously to resolve the complaints relating to medical aid schemes. Council receives thousands of complaints every financial year, and this year keeps growing. We have received 6,138 complaints in the period under review. We have resolved 5,963 complaints during that period. Most complaints relate to mainly non or short payment of the prescribed minimum benefits that our members so dearly and need. This slide looks busy, but you will see it in the actual hard copy of the continue to grow younger. You will hear further from my colleagues that there is an impact that the government's employees medical schemes, that is GEMS, has had on this industry. It tends to attract more younger people into it, the government employees, the GEMS. It is also going to be made clear to the members of parliament that the gross contribution income, the money that collects collected from the contributions of individuals to the scheme, that money has increased over a period of time. Currently, as we speak, 94 billion rand is in the period under review, but as we speak right now, this is actually 807 billion rand. There's an increase in the expenditure on hospitals and specialists. The chairperson has alluded to that. Of concern would obviously be maybe the administration expenditure of all medical schemes, which has risen. But since 2005, the members, you will appreciate the fact that when the council started to apply more pressure on medical schemes to reduce their non-healthcare expenditure, there has been a gradual decline in non-health cost in real terms. That is a progress and, in fact, a success on the part of the regulatory framework that is currently being done by the Council for Medical Schemes. We have and we've supported the NHI process. We will continue to be involved as much as we can in assisting that process and informing it of our experience. And over the 12 years that we've been in existence, during which time we've put in a lot of expertise, and the Council for Medical Schemes continues to have that. So we'll continue with the strategy, with supporting of that strategic view and promoting the medical scheme market that is efficient and effective. Now, I think that I'm now going to ask the CFO to come over. As I'm doing so, I am proud, Chairperson, of the fact that the Auditor General provided this council with the cleanest, which is the 12th unqualified audit report, and I've taken into consideration the concerns that were raised by this committee before with regards to what does it actually mean to have a clean audit report. Would you like to come over at the end at this side? Thank you, Chairperson.
You are 14 years old, and you've got 12 years. 12 years, not 14. Oh, okay. So since you said that you have never had qualified students.
Thank you, Chairperson. We're presenting our annual financial statements for the period 2011-2012, and I think I do not want to underscore that the first thing that we want to present is that we have received an unqualified audit opinion for the statements, and I'm just going to show you how those how that particular unqualified audit opinion was obtained. We present to you the statement of financial position. If I look in this house, you'll better understand it as a balance sheet. Because this is a new terminology for the old balance sheet as you knew it. And the statement of financial performance would be the income statement as you knew it. Now it's we are doing that also because we've got a very rigorous internal control processes. We have compiled our internal controls in what we call finance and procedure manual, which we review almost every year. The statement of financial position, like I've indicated, is mainly you have your balance sheet, which contains your assets and liabilities. We do not have a lot of assets, Chairperson. Our main category of assets would be our office furniture, our office equipment, including the computers that we use. We only have one item, that is part of our assets. And in terms of the cash and cash equivalents, as you can see, we at the end of the financial year, we had about 11 million, which would be a surplus in a sense, which would carry us in our operations in the following months to come. If you look at the graphic presentation, our assets contains of the intangibles, which represent about 3%, 19% being our trade and other receivables, and property, plant and equipment, which is about 21%, and cash and cash equivalents, as you would have noticed, is about 57%, which was the 11 million in the balance sheet there. And under our liability, intangible assets would be the software that is either developed in the organization for purposes of running some of our databases, or the software that you acquire out of the shop in order to make your computer operate. So those are the things that you do not see, the software that you do not see or touch. The current liabilities there, if you compare those current liabilities, as you can see, 11.5 million. Effectively, we did not have money because we needed to settle those liabilities in terms of the cash and cash equivalent there. You see, we've got 11.5, and the only cash we had was also about 11. It was equivalent to that. The provisions in the main was the bonus provision. We've got a performance management system that pays out outstanding performance in the organization for our employees before the end of the financial year. But at the time of preparing this financial statement, we had not yet paid for those, so that they could only be paid by the end of June. The policy states that the performance bonus will be paid by the end of June. So we needed to make provision for that. Operating lease payable, that is merely, as you are aware, we do not own a building. We are leasing our office space. And in terms of disclosure, that is mainly the expenditure items, we have administrative expenses, which I'll explain, and the audit fees, which encompasses the external audit fees paid to the Auditor General and our internal audit fees. This is an outsourced function. The internal audit function is being outsourced to a company called Sizwe Kaluwa Kobora, and our operating expenses account for about 21%, depreciation and amortization. As you can appreciate, being a service organization, the major expenditures are our staff costs, that is salaries and benefits that are being paid to our employees. Administrative expenses, as I've indicated, we do not own a building. We are renting out a building, and that constitutes about 42% of these administrative expenses. Building expenses, we've undergone a renovation exercise this year of about 24%. 13% of that being telecommunication and network telecommunication, websites and internet expenses, telephone, and 11% of that went to other expenses, and we have indicated the general administrative expenses, which will include also the cost of our annual report as well in that regard. This our operating expenses, the legal fees, as you can see, we spend about 55% of our operating expenses went towards legal fees. And I think the point was made that we're being challenged in the industry, and I think a comparison was made by OMSIC schemes, which spent 10 times much more we have spent in the financial. They spent about 27 times more, 27 million, and we've only spent about 10 million in order for us to be a credible regulator. Committee expenses, we'll explain why it's that. It's for members of the council. We've got the council, which serves like a board, which is constituted by about 15 members, and the fees were adjusted during the year in retrospective from the 1st of April. That is also what explains the big jump. Also, there were some committees established during the year to deal specifically with our contribution to the development of the NHI process. So we had established a special committee to look into this, to do conduct some research, so that we are able to contribute to this National Health Policy Directive. So a special committee was established in that regard. Other expenses and consumer education. Consumer education, Chairperson, we are crisscrossing the country in order to make the consumers of these services aware of their rights and their obligations. We also are conducting some exhibitions in platforms like URENT, it's the show, Pretoria show, and wherever we find an opportunity to do so and expose ourselves to the general members of this industry. Investigation costs, as we've indicated, where the irregularities identified in the entities that we regulate, we go in and investigate. And I think as a result, you see that the result of that, we either put a scheme into under curatorship because we find some irregularities and we correct this. I think the registrars alluded to the fact that we've got two schemes now under curatorship because we've investigated this. Chairperson, that is my presentation. I think we'll take questions. I'll then give my colleague Michael Wood to come and continue with this presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair. My role is in this morning is to touch on the non-financial data, as well as operations, review of operations and medical schemes in the previous financial year. In the previous financial year, what I'll be touching on is just to give a sense on how many medical schemes we had. Also to, and then also just to give a sense on how many benefit options, beneficiaries, and then how were healthcare services used in the previous financial year. And also just to touch on the expenditure trends. I thought it would be important to start with the strategic goal number 1 of the Council for Medical Schemes, which seeks sure that there are benefit options that members can benefit from. So if you look over the years, I decided telemarketing to touch on 2002 and 2005 and 2011 data, just to give a sense on how many schemes all existed, and also just to explain further the consolidation in the medical schemes environment. In 2002, we had 143 medical schemes, and then in 2005, 131, and then in 2011, it's 97 medical schemes. Now, if you were to compare the period between 2005 and 2002 to the period to 2011 and 2005, you will realize or note that we have lost, on the period 2005 to 2011, we have lost the rate of the medical schemes that you lose is twice. That was the case between 2002 and 2011. So we actually see a collective consolidation in the medical schemes environment. Obviously, there are a number of reasons that are attributed to that. But on the other side, if you were to look at the number of benefit options that exist in the medical schemes environment, we are actually seeing an increasing trend as opposed to the declining trend that you see in the number of registered medical schemes. Obviously, the number of medical schemes that have existed is attributed, in fact, the decline or the consolidation in terms of medical schemes that have existed is attributed to a number of factors. One of the main drivers is the measures that have taken place in the market. So if you were to analyze over the period 2002 to 2011, and you sort of like to, on average, compute how many schemes you sort of like lose in an environment due to measures, you will note that it's actually three medical schemes that you lose. So the underlying message is that, yes, even though there's a decline in the number of schemes that are registered, there's sort of like an increase in the average number of benefit options. If you were to split that analysis on benefit options by open schemes and restricted schemes, open schemes actually offer more benefit options compared to the restricted schemes. Now, I also thought it would be important to also touch on strategic goal number two of the Council for Medical Schemes, which speaks about the fact that medical schemes are properly governed, responsive to the environment, and the beneficiaries are informed and protected. Now, it might be that this is our goal, it's something that we want to achieve, but there are other external factors that affect the consolidation that is presented in the previous slide in ensuring that the medical schemes are responsive. Yes, the medical scheme can be responsive, but then there's an issue of aging beneficiaries which we cannot avoid. And then medical schemes need to respond to such challenges. And then also, there's an issue of declining membership in some schemes. Medical schemes need to develop strategies to mitigate those risks. And then also, there are problems with regards to governance failures in the medical schemes environment, and they are increasing healthcare costs. So these are some of the challenges that are faced by medical schemes. And then the existence of us is to ensure that to actually assist medical schemes to be able to mitigate or sort of like respond to some of these risks. Now, in terms of people of covered lives, if you were to look at the period between 2010 and 2011, we are seeing a decline in the number of beneficiaries that are covered in open schemes as opposed to registered schemes. And then the trend that we are seeing overall is that from 2010 to 2011, we saw an increase of 2.5% from 8.3 to 8.5 million beneficiaries. The trend, or what is emanating from this slide, is that we are seeing members moving, members moving from the open schemes environment to the restricted schemes environment. So those are the trends that we are seeing. Also, talking to the challenges that are actually faced by the open schemes environment, to say that some of those challenges speaks to the aging profile of beneficiaries that I explained in the previous slide. We are also going to see in the next slide on when we sort of like compare the age profile of open and restricted schemes. Now, if you were to look at the trends over time from 2000 until 2011, in 2000, 6.7 million beneficiaries. In 2011, we had 8.5. That is an increase of about 26.9%. It looks slightly significant, but if you were to look at the real numbers, 6.7 to 8.5 million over that period, it's not really a significant increase. And then also, if you were to compare the open schemes environment from 4.7 in 2000 to 4.8, also that also not a significant increase. But the significant significant growth has been noted if you look at the resident scheme environment that have increased from 2.1 million to 3.7 million beneficiaries in 2011. Obviously, the attributes to that is actually the expense of the government employees' medical schemes, whereby previously you had people who were not covered, but now they have got medical cover. Now, if you were to look at the age profile of members who belong to schemes, in medical schemes, the average age of people who belong to schemes in 2011 was 31.6. Comparative figure to that was 31.5. So what we are seeing is like slight aging in the average age of beneficiaries in schemes. But then if you were to look to compare that now to a split between the open environment and the risk environment, we are seeing a slightly older age profile, whereby in open schemes the average age is 3 compared to 29.5 in the resident scheme environment. So the attribute really to that is obviously the extent of GEMS, whereby GEMS, if you were to look at GEMS average age, it's more or less the same as what you see on the resident scheme environment, slightly less than 30 years of age. So the attribute really that you see to the fact that the resident schemes are younger is because of GEMS. We are also going to see in the next slide, if you take GEMS out of the equation, what effect does it bring into all of this? Now, this is the trend line that is looking at the average age of beneficiaries from 2004 to 2011. The blue flag is open schemes, and then the green graph is actually consolidated, and then the last two is the resident schemes. One includes GEMS and the other one excludes GEMS. If we were to exclude GEMS in the red one, what you are going to see is that if you exclude GEMS in the purple one, the average age of resident schemes slightly moves up, actually slightly above 31. But if you look at resident schemes and then including GEMS, it's slightly younger at around 29.5, which clearly indicates the gap between those two clearly indicates the impact or the effect of GEMS. Now, if you were to look at the utilization of services, what we saw in the previous financial year compared to 2011 is that we saw an increase in the use of healthcare facilities or healthcare services, whereby if you were to look at private hospitals, we saw an increase in the number of people who were admitted, and we also saw an increase in the average length of stay from 167.7 in 2010 to 178.81 in 2011 per 1,000 beneficiaries. Also, patients stayed 0.2 days longer in private hospitals compared to the previous financial year. Now, if you were to look at the primary healthcare services in this case, the GPs, dentists, as well as the private nurses, very few beneficiaries utilize those services, meaning therefore that if you were to compare the comparative years figures, it's sort of like a decline there. The reason to that is because most of the members sort of like informed to an extent that they don't necessarily go through or via the primary healthcare services. They would rather go direct to specialists, which undermines the role of the gatekeeping there. Beneficiaries in resident schemes, they use healthcare services more often for longer than in open schemes. This is attributed again if you were to go back to GEMS. You see, it's not the case that we are looking at GEMS, but then there are attributes or threats that are emanating to the fact that most of the people are previously not covered, but then now they are covered. So that will have an impact on what we are seeing there. This slide actually tries to illustrate the utilization of healthcare services. How do we define healthcare services in this case? The utilization of healthcare services in this case is people who are admitted in private hospital. So what we're trying to do there, we're trying to split people who are admitted in hospital by age band. So what we are noting there is that beneficiaries or dependents, or this would be like dependents, in that age band, 1 to 4, they stay longer in hospital up to an average of about 5 days. And then also, all the beneficiaries stay in hospital up to, in 2011, it's slightly more than 5 days, but in 2010, it was slightly, it was nearly about 4 days in hospital. So the drivers really, with regards to private hospital utilization, is mostly the younger ones and the older age beneficiaries. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's just that it's how the market is designed. It is expected that all the beneficiaries utilize the services. to look at benefits paid, what I'm trying to illustrate here is the major cost drivers in the with regards to healthcare services. In 2011, like, $6.2 billion was claimed from the providers. The bigger contributor, obviously, was the private hospitals there. And then second to that was medical, was other disciplines, which will also include the supplied and allied healthcare professionals. And then that was followed by the, in fact, also on that one, on the others, also include GPs. The right one is medical specialists, and the last one is total medicines. But then the major cost drivers in this particular case will be total hospitals, medical specialists, and medicines. And then the three of them, they make roughly around 70% of all benefits paid. So these are the cost drivers with regards, or the highest claimers in the market. And then if we were to take the very same data and then analyze it over time and then adjust for beneficiaries, what we know that private hospitals, the expenditure there was 330 spot 7 per beneficiary per month, with medical specialists 208 and medicines 148. Also, what we are noting there is that the increase, those three are again the cost drivers. Maybe an important message to take home here with regards to this trend is that the private hospitals, medical specialists, they fall outside the jurisdiction or the jurisdiction of the Council for Medical Schemes. We try to negotiate and then also to come up with innovative ways of dealing with the problems in reducing the, in containing the cost. But then really the challenge is that they are unregulated, they are not regulated by the Council for Medical Schemes. And then here, the strategic goal number 3 to 4 of the Council for Medical Schemes speaks to the fact that the Council is responsible to the needs of the environment, provide influential strategic advice and support to the healthcare policy. Really, the idea here, with my message with regards to the slide is that we, as the Council for Medical Schemes, we try and then and try and find innovative ways to respond to the industry. Some of those innovative ways was alluded to by Dr. Gacho on the composite risk index. What we are trying to do, we try to be a proactive regulator by trying to create internal resources that will assist us to be a more effective and proactive regulator. Because at the ultimate end of the day, we want to get or achieve a results-driven healthcare system. Yeah, thanks. That's all from me.
Higher than that in claims,
And there's a couple of reasons why we saw that, which I will speak to. But the most important is because in 2009, medical schemes, most medical schemes had a very bad year. Now, in the last 2 years, they've been trying to correct their pricing to recover those losses that they made in 2009. This slide is essentially the same as the previous one, except that it has been adjusted for lives. PABPM means per average beneficiary per month. So on average, members or beneficiaries paid 1,063.9 in contributions, and out of that 1,063.9, 966.6 is the portion that is left over after removing savings. Out of that, 836.3 went to claims. So if you take 116.2 rand paid for savings plans contributions as well as the risk portion, it will give you the total contributions paid by the member. Similarly with claims, if you take risk contributions of risk claims of 836.3 together with the savings claims of 109.1 rand, that will give you total claims paid by the member. And again, a similar trend as the previous slide is notable, where the rate of increase in contributions is higher than that in claims. This slide speaks to the claims ratio over time. The claims ratio is simply claims expressed as a function of contributions. The brown bar is risk contribution, so we've removed the savings element, which is really for discretionary benefits, and then the green bar is risk claim, so it's everything that is paid out of the risk pool, the member's risk pool. Now, you'll see that in the earlier years, there was like a downward trend in claims, and that's the same period during which medical schemes needed to build up reserves, because the Act was promulgated in 2000. So they had 5 years to build up to solvency. So it appears that at that time, medical schemes build up reserves at the expense of claims. In 2004, that was the deregulation of prices by the Competition Commission, and that is why from then on there was that upsurge in claims. 2006, introduction of self-payment gaps and deductibles, which explains the downward trend because more was being paid out of members' pockets essentially through deductibles and self-payment gaps. This is the year that I just alluded to, 2009, where generally most schemes, particularly the big ones, had major losses. And in the last 2 years, generally the industry has been correcting for that through their pricing, where the rate at which contributions is increasing is higher than that in claims, so that more can actually go towards reserve building and maintaining the sustainability of the industry. This slide speaks to claims as well as non-healthcare expenditure. It has been adjusted for inflation, so it's reflected in 2011 prices. The brown area is total expenditure. So if you take claims, which is the green bar, as well as non-healthcare expenditure, they give you the brown area. The sum of those give you the brown area. The green bar, okay, my pointer just died. The green bar is essentially what is impacted by things like what is happening around tariffs, you know, those kind of issues, the pricing kind of issues that the registrar also has alluded to. Blue is non-healthcare expenditure, so everything that is spent on operational kind of expenses is the blue bar. What we've seen is that over time, non-healthcare expenditure of medical schemes has declined in real terms. There's again a couple of reasons why, you know, that is happening. In the registrar's office, there are, you know, a couple of interventions that specifically deal with non-health because it continues to be an area of concern. The most important of which is the process through which medical scheme rules are registered. In that registration process, medical schemes essentially have to motivate the elements in which they've included in their pricing, specifically non-health expenditure where it is deemed to be excessive. these are the elements that we've priced in, and these are the reasons, and that would have to be tested to, for reasonability, and such that the impact ultimately on the member is not excessive. Yes, actually my later slides break down non-healthcare expenditure. Yeah, we've been. Those are the elements that make up non-healthcare expenditure. Gross admin expenditure, that is the line item that speaks to things like trustee fees, principal officer fees, administration fees, banking fees. So all operational expenses are grouped together to make up gross admin expenditure. Managed healthcare management services, that's the expenditure on items such as pre-authorization, case management, you know, your pharmaceutical benefits management, those kind of interventions. And then you've got broker fees and then bed debts. So together those elements make up non-healthcare expenditure. In the year under review, total expenditure on non-healthcare was 12.1 billion, which represented an increase of 4.8. If you look at that based on open and restricted, one will see that expenditure in restricted schemes per life, per average beneficiary per month, saw an increase of 2.7% to 76.1 rand compared to the 4.8 increase in the open schemes to 154.1 rand. This slide shows non-healthcare expenditure adjusted for inflation. Now, one will see that from about 2008, there's a real decrease. So in real terms, there's actually a decrease in the amount of money that medical schemes are spending on non-healthcare expenditure. The earlier years were the pre-regulation years, where before the Medical Schemes Act was promulgated, where expenditure on non-healthcare was actually exceeding that on healthcare expenditure. So over the years, there have been several interventions, the Act and various other operational interventions at the Registrar's Office that are, you know, seeking to reduce expenditure, unnecessary expenditure on non-healthcare. Gross admin expenditure. In open schemes, there was a total of 5.6 billion spent, representing an increase of 3%, compared to restricted schemes, which spend a total of 2.4 billion, representing an increase of 9.1% from the previous year. Now, the reason for that is that in the restricted scheme environment, there was about a 7% increase in the number of lives covered. So essentially, you've got more lives under administration in the restricted scheme space, which is why that increase is higher. And that is largely due to GEMS, which has had an increase of about 17% on their membership base. When you adjust those figures for membership, in 2011, open schemes spent 101.4 compared to 54.9 for restricted schemes. Managed healthcare management services, so the admin element of managed healthcare, not the healthcare element, this is pre-authorization, case management, as I alluded to earlier. Expenditure on managed healthcare management services was 2.4 in 2011, representing an increase of 8.3%. And almost all of the beneficiaries in the medical schemes are covered by such interventions. 98.8% of all beneficiaries are in fact covered by these kind of managed care interventions. Broker costs increased by 5% to 1.4 billion in 2011. At a per average member per month basis, this represented 46.8 rand compared to 44.4 rand in 2010. Now, this must be looked at against the backdrop of what has happened to the membership numbers. Expenditure on broker costs has increased by 5%, but overall there has only been a 3.3% increase in lives covered. And again, the majority of that growth
has occurred in restricted schemes which generally do not pay brokerage. This graph shows expenditure on broker fees specifically for those schemes that had that pay out broker fees, and you relate that to membership, which is the red line. Since 2000, the average spend on broker fees has increased by about 206% compared to only an 84% growth in membership. So which again, you know, indicates that there's definitely a lag between the rate at which broker expenditure on brokerage is increasing when you compare that to the number of lives that it's supposed to be bringing into the industry. The blue line is results from operations. So that is basically contributions less claims, as well as all the other operational expenses. When you add investment income, we get your net surplus, which gives you the orange line. One can see that over time, the medical schemes have continued to rely on investment income to boost their results. If one looks at from 2000 to 2004, there is an upward trend which coincides with the period during which medical schemes needed to build reserves. In 2009, there were four big schemes that together were attributable, more than 50% of the industry's loss was due to four large schemes. Now, in 2010 and 2011, that's the correction in pricing that I referred to, which has resulted in the industry essentially almost doubling its profits when you compare to 2010. A lot of the changes in operational results occurred in the schemes that are below solvency. So one saw the biggest improvement in all of this in most of the schemes that are below 25, again suggesting that there is a concerted effort by those schemes to build reserves and actually comply with the Medical Schemes Act. This slide indicates overall solvency in the industry. The red line is prescribed solvency per Regulation 29. All medical schemes are essentially supposed to be at 25%, bar those that are newly registered where there's a phase in solvency levels allowed for them. The green line indicates overall solvency over the last 11 years, and one can see that in 2011, the average solvency was 32.6 for all medical schemes, which is still above the required 25%. But obviously, if one starts looking at a granular level, there are medical schemes that are below 25%, and those are being engaged appropriately by the registrar. This slide speaks to schemes, only those schemes that are below 25%. If you look on the left, it's open schemes. On the right is restricted schemes. So in 2011, there were 9 open schemes representing 2.8 million lives. So 9 schemes that are below 25% represented by 2.8 million lives. Now, one needs to make mention that of those lives, the biggest part was because of Discovery, the largest open schemes, which is below solvency. Similarly, for restricted schemes, of the 1.865 million lives, 1.6 million lives were in GEMS, which is also below solvency. So if you take up the two largest schemes in the country, both from an open perspective and a restricted perspective, that picture could look substantially different. So it is affected by the biggest players in both open and restricted schemes. For example, for restricted schemes, GEMS represented about 90% of the 1865 lives shown there. This slide shows overall trends in the industry. And essentially, what has happened in the industry since the introduction of GEMS in 2006. The red line is the pensioner ratio for restricted schemes. green line is the pensioner ratio for open schemes. As Michael indicated, the restricted schemes is getting younger because a lot of the growth is happening in GEMS, which typically has younger members, and therefore is impacting on the open schemes, which are aging. What is also happening is that some of the members that were in open schemes traditionally designed to attract government employees are leaving those schemes to join GEMS, and therefore impacting on the aging population of the open scheme industry. The pink line is the solvency for open schemes, now sitting at 28.6% compared to 38.3% for restricted schemes. The restricted scheme solvency has also been affected by the growth in GEMS, because as members move to join GEMS, they do not bring reserves with them, and that has an impact on your solvency calculation. Thank you. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you. I'm not sure whether you want to say something, acting chair, or that.
No, at this point, I think what needs to have been said has been said. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. So thank you very much for those presentations. Everybody who's come down here, they didn't come for, they used their money effectively because everybody presented, everybody talked. Maybe that's why you've got a clean audit. You know how to use your money. It would be really interesting that your organization was formed after 1994. And it's one of those organizations that is doing so well, as assessed by the Auditor General, which says something about the fact that most of the problems that we have are relating to the past. Why other areas we've got difficulties is related to our past, how we're handling our past, because you don't have a past. You started at that time and you are continuing to do well. I'm not sure if I'm understood what I'm trying to say. But the other thing that becomes very important here is that you are regulating medical aid schemes, and but still healthcare is becoming so expensive, meaning that there's another area that has been left unattended, which is coming very clearly from your presentation, that the cost drivers are the hospitals that are not being regulated, and partly the specialists. I think one day we called the doctors here who were having a problem with their tariffs. We should have invited you to be part of that so that you could give us some research work as to why are those problems. And I'm not sure whether are they being regulated or what the HPCSA is doing to make sure that those costs are done. But this is actually making one of the big problems. The non-healthcare costs, it's very interesting because the minister always talks about the fact that doctors are not getting much from the medical aid, but the non-medical or non-healthcare costs are the ones that are getting the big benefit. But it's interesting that they're going down. I think one would underline that and look at that. There's something that mentions the decrease in medical aid schemes. Now, is that a good or a bad thing? That the decrease of medical aid, is it good or is it bad? Knowing very well that we're forward looking into the national health insurance, what is going to, how do you prepare yourselves towards the national health insurance, and how do you see yourself? Are you seeing yourself going to be part of that, or are you seeing yourself disappearing when the national health insurance? How do you see yourselves going forward with some of the medical aid schemes that are coming up? There's something about length of stay in hospital. And I know tomorrow is the national or the international day of hospice, which is sort of a down, what do you call it, to say, a down referral system of patients that need to be in hospital. Do medical aid schemes help? yes, the hospices. The last one, maybe the CEO of the register will tell us. The chairperson is acting. I think it's quite a long time since we saw the other chairperson coming in here. Or is it the department that we need to ask that question? But we need to know why it's such a period, especially with an organization that is doing so well. That is not only having an unqualified audit report, but is having a clean report, meaning that even your performance is quite good. Not only that is the acting chairperson, I think Uwin is acting too. I think we need to know why are we not here, but we don't know how long he is acting, but it would be very interesting to know what's going on. Maybe members, that is the report. I was just trying to summarize some of the things that I picked up then. We are trying to be very short, but sometimes we become very long when we say we are trying to be short. I think everybody, or very few, everybody is going to ask a question. So you can start to mess with it.
Check all those things
when they claim, why do they claim for ICU and not for an ordinary ward, given the condition that we are admitted with non-health expenditure? The question that Chairperson was asking. What about this wage salary? Is it not falling under the non-health expenditure? What?
Yeah,
this statement that comes off non-health care expenditure, whether the salaries and the bonuses fall in, because I thought maybe it will fall under those, that category. But also the report, according to me, I don't know other people, has got, excuse me, something to do with medical aid schemes, but also something to do with Council for Medical Aid Scheme. You are reporting about medical aid schemes, how they spend their money and blah, blah, blah. And I never have the touch of how do you spend your monies, because you get contribution from us, but I don't know where it is. Maybe if somebody can clarify me, because most of the graphs that I saw that relates to money talks of medical aid schemes, but not of U.S. cancer. The last question is around committees. There are committees that are partaking. I would like to be advised as to who are these committee members? Are they us from the medical schemes, or is people from outside who are just, you know, coming to be voted in? How long do they stay? What is their role? Because there are at least some stipend that I think they are getting, if they are. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. You'll just record most of the questions. I think you'll correct me if I'm wrong, because my understanding is wrong, is that you are an organization which is the Council for Medical Aid Schemes that is regulating medical aid. So your work is around looking at how healthy or how bad are they treating us, the medical aid. So you mainly that's what we are doing. Okay. Another one.
Can you please, in the future, when you say SCA, can just explain it so that we must know and understand what you mean. But when you say CMS, we know how is CMS. But if you can write the full sentence and then put the CSA in the bracket, then we'll understand. Like on the other slide, number 3, how rent has become eater. It's because I'm not part of the medical team, I can't understand. And then I can't tell somebody who are saying about 1, 2, 3. Please, in future, can assist us. And then I have a question of rural areas. Has the CMS gone to the rural areas to inform the beneficiaries or make the roadshow about your scheme so that they must understand or they must be part of this scheme? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. There are two people who are very happy with that. There's another one from Fenty, and there's another one from Tolo. They're happy that you're talking about rural areas. They're very happy that you are representing them. You are regulating an industry of 1.7 billion. Turnover. Yet your budget is about 98 million. Are they not looking down upon you? Because they are the big guns, and they say we can take you to court whenever we want to take you to court because we've got money and you don't have enough money. Okay, members, you must have a question.
No, the chairperson said that everybody is going to have a fight. That is why I didn't like raise their hands. Thank you very much, chairperson, and thanks for the presentation. Yesterday I told other entities that I'm no more new, because in 2009 we were saying that we are new, now we are old. And my problem is, at a certain stage I asked myself, what happened to this discussion, our discussion, like when we are sitting here, we raise certain things. What do you do about them when you go back? Do you just have a special meeting whereby you reflect on what you were saying and you come up with action plan to what we are saying, so that on a yearly basis we shouldn't be asking you the same thing? Because like I'm here, I'm a nurse by profession, but I told you earlier that irrespective that I'm nurse by profession, I've been working in the Department of Health. I didn't know about your existence. I didn't know when I'm having a problem, whom to talk to. My colleague have talked about it, to be saying, how do you really make sure that you have been known there? One of the presenters said that you even go to rent Easter shows, all those things. Now, I'm a person from Manzara, next to Swartland, next to Gartenport. You don't even know me. I haven't even gone to rent Easter show. How do you cater for me so that at the end of the day, whatever you are, the clean audit you are having is really like the correct thing it represents us all? Because I think if you expand and be known by everybody, at the end of the day, the picture can change. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying. Another presenter talked about the amendment of the medical scheme bill. I would like to know, how does an ordinary person at the street participate on this bill? How will you sell this thing to an ordinary person at the street? The National Health Insurance. You talked about the National Health, your participation. And whenever we discuss National Health, and we talk National Health Insurance, we find that there is this belief to be saying that people who are more afraid of the National Health Insurance are the medical insurance, because it is an insurance, the National Health, it is an insurance. And people are, maybe people are scared to be saying that when it comes over, it will like take over, everybody will go there. I want to know, how do you see that? In your page 60 and to 61, you have talked about the tenders. There are two tenders which are under adjudication. What values are those tenders? How much does it? I want to know if the asset registers have been properly updated. Have all creditors been paid up to date? Staff turnaround appear to be low. How was this achieved? Because we find that many a time there is a lot of staff turnover. Is it because we are only situated in Evans? That is where you are staff turnover is low. I would like to be clarified there. I want to even repeat this of rural area, because since 2009, if you remember, I have been among the people who have been very concerned about it, but I really want clarity now. What happened to a government worker when they retire or resign? Will they be eligible for GEM, or will they not? If like I'm in GEM and I retire, will I be eligible to get that? The last you talk about, there are somewhere where you talk about the primary health care. And the number seems to be very low. Then I want to know, is it not because the primary health care in public is not payable? You don't pay for the primary health care. Yeah, even the dentists fall under the primary health care. And most of the patient goes there, but they don't pay. I will only go and pay if I go to a private clinic. Is it not a cause why the amount is too low? Chairperson, I think the last one. Okay. And you have even talked about older. The people who are coming in medical age to be saying that it's a younger generation and the older ones are a little bit the number is low. Is it not because when I get out of the system of the government, I no more being eligible to be a member of the
of the scheme. The last one is the input which was done by the deputy chairperson was very valuable, and we were supposed to really look at it and really talk about it. But most unfortunately, it was nowhere documented. And you find like when the second presenter presented, she said that most of the overview of the commission was covered by the deputy chair. But the most important thing is it's not written. Sometimes you struggle to listen, but because of the accent and because of certain things, the illiterate part of it, I don't hear and understand. But if it is written, I would like follow it up. In future, I will really say that it should be. I don't know, is it in the bigger, okay. But it's because I have never heard it for some reason. I think you must help us, you summarize it so that you can see it. Thank you, Chairperson.
We don't want to be out of this place at 12 o'clock, so you can give us the responses. Maybe let's apologize. Oh, I've forgotten you. Let us apologize for that part, because I think Mr. Bailey was actually reading his own report, which is written in the annual report that we have. So he was actually reading from there, and it's written by him, and he was reading it. So it is there. It's only we apologize for you not getting it, because I don't think it was distributed to everybody earlier. So it will be distributed. You'll get it. Okay, Honorable...
Thank you.
they've got about 8 million membership. And most of that 8 million membership are the people that are well-to-do. And by that, most of them, they stay in big towns. So now it is the work of the Medical League, you know, their brokers who should go and see what's happening in rural areas if people could afford Medical League, but you regulate them. So I think this must not be going into your performance, but it's something that you can help us to help those that are in rural areas if they want to ask questions, because there are few that are in rural areas who've got Medical Aid. And that goes to this last question that is coming, that I suppose some of the business people, they always think about their money. How am I going to make money? And if something doesn't make a lot of money, which goes to the palliative care, which goes to the primary health care, if there's not much money that they're making, the business people don't want to go that direction. They want to go to the direction that they can make as much money, which actually talks on two things. It talks on regulating the hospital industry, on regulating the private doctor. And at the same time, the second one is to find out why can't they be helping with their money in the primary health care that is cheaper to run, and the palliative care that is cheaper to run, which we definitely need, especially us who are getting old now, because we're going towards that direction, and we need somebody who's going to look after me when I'm old, when I can't afford to go to a big private hospital. Somebody needs to look after me. Okay, we don't have a lot of time, but let's give over to you.
Thank you. There are a wide-ranging set of questions that have been asked. I must tell you, certainly I don't have all the answers. That's why we're a team effort. So I'll deal with some of them, and I have little doubt that my colleagues will be able to add substance to them, and obviously they will be invited to, to come in. Obviously, the first issue that was just really raised by the chair related to the cost drivers and so far as hospitals and specialists are concerned. Now, obviously, those cost drivers, in a sense, fall outside of the ambit of the Medical Schemes Act. But clearly, we have been giving some thought to this, and in fact, we recently met with the minister, and this issue came up. And what's very clear is that we need to start taking a more holistic view around how regulators operate. Certainly, the minister has indicated that there is an inter-regulatory committee that is going to start sitting again. So, for example, we can start having discussions with health professions, councils, and other bodies, and so we can be talking to each other about our various efforts of the areas that we regulate, and therefore, so what may fall outside of our ambit can certainly be dealt with by other regulatory bodies. The other thing just on those cost drivers, of course, is that the Competition Tribunal a number of years ago, in fact, made a ruling that, in fact, it would be anti-competitive to set prices. We can inform you that the tribunal is again beginning to revisit that issue. And so there may be some changes around that, but certainly that seems to be an answer for later in terms of the actual outcome there. I mean, so far as decrease in medical schemes, is that a good or a bad?
Is that one of the competition tribunal? As parliamentarians, because they are guided by law, do you think there's something that we can do as parliamentarians? Because it's really killing the industry. I'm going to say, I can't argue with the doctor next door. I mean, we can't set a price as doctors because we're not going to be seen as competition. Is there something that we can do as parliamentarians? We would want that suggestion, from you, if you could tell us.
Yeah. I mean, the registrar will deal with it. Do you want to deal with it now?
Maybe I should. Thanks, Chair. The Competition Tribunal 2004 came up with that ruling, as it has been mentioned, and a number of the stakeholders were penalized, particularly the associations of the hospitals, of the medical doctors. chairperson out of that process that the parliamentarians will have to come in when the minister has made a determination coming out of that inquiry as to what then needs to be changed in laws. And there will therefore be two sets of legislations here that will have to be either amended or legislated, depending on the property of knowledge that comes with that, one being the Department of Health and the Ministry of Health on one hand, and the DTI, Department of Trade and Industry, on the other hand, because here are the healthcare costs being looked into, but the determining factor, in fact, lies with the Department of Trade and Industry. Then that becomes a parliamentary issue.
Thank you. Concerning the decrease in medical schemes, it's argued that it's not necessarily anything to worry about at this stage. It's just part of the natural attrition progress that is taking place. I think if we got to a point where we were down to 3 or 4 medical schemes and we were starting to talk about monopolies and so on, it would be cause for concern. The issue of prescribed minimum benefits has perhaps contributed in some way to the decrease in those schemes, but the prescribed minimum benefits battle has at last been won, where in fact medical schemes are now being told that they have to pay those prescribed minimum benefits in full. That's clearly in the best interests of all beneficiaries. And if one or two schemes are simply not going to meet solvency and other requirements, then in fact that may not be a bad thing. And because obviously those requirements for medical schemes to be accredited are there for the protection of beneficiaries. So not something that we think we need to be at all concerned about at this stage. And so far as the NHI is concerned, I think that at last there seems to be some form of quietness descending upon all the noise that has taken place around NHI. Obviously there are always going to be interests, but we saw in fact Discovery the other day coming out in support of it, certainly because they're probably now beginning to see some role for themselves in that process. We at the Council take the view that we want to support these interventions to the extent that we can. We place putting a lot of energy into our contribution to the Green Paper, the White Paper. We think we're at the beginning of this debate, and it's likely that there will be something uniquely South African that will come out of this as the debate unfolds. Certainly, it's my personal view is that I think you're going to see the private industry participating quite actively in the matter. So, for example, in our meeting with the minister a week and a half ago, he just gave an example of the TAS system where the private hospital, 70% may be made up of so-called private beds with private patients, and the other 30% of beds are actually being filled through the equivalent of their NHR. So there's no doubt that the hope, and I really believe that in fact the end result will be, is that it's going to be a win-win for everyone. I think what we've got to do is we've got to have the conversation, we've got to have the dialogue. Let's see where we go on it and come up with something that has the greatest benefit for the greatest number. On length of stays, I'm going to leave to my colleagues to speak about. So you raised the issue just of the acting chairpersonship. We can on that score just say to you that Dr. Rejoice Maloney, in fact, was the chairperson, and she took over from Professor Pick until the end of June. I've been acting since then. The issue is with the minister. As you know, he's a man who considers things in detail and so forth, and he is making decisions in that regard. We don't believe that that having an acting chair currently provides any form of strategic threat to the organisation. The organisation continues in the normal course of its work, and we've shown you today that we are doing good work. I suppose you just raised also issues around budgets. Now, certainly our view is that we would always like more money. The issue of legal costs has come up, and we believe that what we do with the amount of money that we have, in fact, is money well spent. Certainly, I can say that the council has never shirked from its responsibility to go to court when it needs to. We've been fortunate that we've recently been winning a number of cases, and as a result, we've been able to recover the costs is played to us. We've taken note of the page numbers. That certainly makes sense, and we're going to make that easier going forward. On how the R24.95 is made up, my colleagues are going to deal with that. I'll also leave just the issue of property renting, renovations, those sorts of things to the registrar, alternatively our CFO. So I'll deal with the issue of the committees. And the committees comprise, in some instances, members of the council, and in some instances, just individual experts who we bring in. So, for example, we have, appeals committees is made up of an expert council, together with members of the, when I say expert council, it's expert advocate. And obviously then made up of members of the council itself to meet with the legislative requirements, and they're obviously remunerated on terms generally agreed with them and approved by Treasury insofar as council members are concerned. Other members obviously are paid at market rates. Ms. Robertson raised the issue about medical aides not always wanting to pay up. And one of the things that we've been seeing recently is that there have been increased numbers of appeals by members of or beneficiaries, members of medical schemes, who have the right, if they believe that the medical aides are not paying what they believe should be paid to them. So we've noticed an increase. And that really, in fact, feeds into the point that you were making, that things are getting expensive, and that's particularly so for older people. But of course, one of the underlying principles of being a member of a medical aid scheme is that the younger people should be paying for the older people. And that's why that number you saw earlier on around is the average membership going up or going down is an important consideration in that process. And what members get is often determined by the terms of the contract that exists between the members and the medical aid. And again, this feeds back into the issue of the prescribed minimum benefits issue. And again, I'll just repeat that the fact that the courts have now come out and said that, in fact, prescribed minimum benefits means paying in full. And we think was a battle well worth fighting and a battle well worth winning, because it's certainly assisting people who would like to be paid or receive more. So I think that's an ongoing issue, and that again then feeds into the question of the administrative cost of medical aids as against the amounts that they're actually paying out. It's something we have been paying close attention to, and I can say that Discovery was a medical aid, by virtue being the biggest. We were concerned that it was spending more money on, let's call it, the administrative cost than it was on paying out benefits. And at our meeting, two meetings ago, we actually asked them to make a presentation to us to explain how these costs were made up. And Discovery have indicated that over a period of time they intend to reduce the administrative costs and bring it down to what we call the 10% guideline. And it is a guideline because you cannot have too strict an interpretation to that. On the issue of gyms, I'm going to let the registrar deal with deal with that. I think also issue education issues we take seriously. We'll let the registrar deal with that and the costs of the reports and so forth. So I think perhaps what I should do, let me stop at this point and we can share the later. Thank you.
I think the question on 107 billion industry being regulated by somebody who's only getting about less than 100 million. It's like there's the one time where the Football Association, some of the players were playing overseas and they were getting better salaries overseas, and they were looking down upon their coach here because they were getting far less here. So, I mean, when the person who's got the bigger purse seems to call the shots. That was the question. Are they not looking down upon you and saying that we can call the shots because we're getting more money than you, so why should we worry about it? But it doesn't matter.
I certainly didn't take it that way at all. In fact, we would sit here today to say that that 107 million, we'd like it to be a bit more. But certainly, I think that the, well, in fact, I can say without a shadow of doubt that the Council for Medical Schemes is seen as being a very strong regulator. And certainly, there are one or two matters that we're running at the moment where we've had absolute compliance from one or two medical aids because we do the accrediting. And if they don't get the so-called license from us, then they're out of business. So that's certainly, one of our strongest cards that we pay. That really then feeds into why at a council level we have indicated to the staff and the employees and the registrar and his team that, that we are not to back off from cases and from fighting cases in the courts. Is that, and we will never ever do that. Obviously, we will be practical about the way we go about things, and we've also made it very clear to the legal team that when you win, you recover the costs on that party and party scale that you you get. So this is not a council that is ever going to stand back from doing what it is required to do.
Thank you, Chair. Just to deal with a number of other questions, as I'm doing so, I will indicate who will be dealing with my other colleagues. Thanks for the compliment of the post-1994 era public entities that has at least done what it has done the best that we could. The cost drivers in the private hospitals and specialists, in addition to what has been said, is the regulation and even a more stricter and stronger regulation of those entities which currently fall outside of our mandate chairperson is what we have been advocating for. We cannot regulate the private hospitals as it is right now in terms of the Act that is mandating us. However, in our interaction and in our advice to the establishers of regulators, and that is where the department and the minister come in, we have certainly made that point, we have made our services and our advice available to have such a regulator available. Let me add that we've also, maybe at the risk of even stretching our budget further, offered as a Council for Medical Schemes, should we be required to do that, we would look into it, provided there is an enabling part in the Medical Aid Schemes Act for us to do so. The specialists are currently regulated by the HPCSA, and therefore the HPCSA has to strengthen and make it be more strict in terms of containing those costs that would be attributable to the specialist, which is an area that the HPCSA does regulate. Again, as the Council for Medical Schemes, we're working very closely with a fellow regulator, being a public entity, which is HPCSA, in assisting it where we can. Number of interactions have taken place with the HPCSA with regards to that. All public entities have to work and not fight against each other. In this case, we're working together because we have identified the slides that we have seen with regards to the driving of costs and the attributable to the specialist. I think the non-healthcare costs declining, that a good sign or a bad sign. My colleague dealt with the FSU will elaborate on that, except to say that any costs that are non-health care related should obviously be kept. They should come down. The money that each and every individual pays towards the medical system should primarily be for delivery of medical and health services. That's the principle from which we move, so that you do not pay on a monthly basis to a scheme and the greater parts of that money, more than 10%, as it is a guide mentioned, in fact it goes to all sorts of things that you sometimes would be very scared to hear, Jefferson, what happens to those monies that you make that go beyond the non-health care costs, but we'll hear more a little bit about that later on. The total number of schemes that is consolidating, and we've seen the slide that shows the number that was in 2002, 2005, and now the number coming down. We have also indicated and shown you that while that number of medical aid schemes is coming down, in fact the beneficiaries and members of the schemes is going up. Good thing or a bad thing, and what trend will that be the case? We're currently standing at 97 medical aid schemes, which basically means if you take that trend, it will take us a long, long time to have 5 medical aid schemes in the country, if I'm making just a town stuck. with 97 at the moment, it is a time that we will have to look at whether in fact such a consolidation is now talking to monopolistic tendencies or oligopolistic tendencies, which are the economic issues. The more they become too concentrated and too few, that brings its own challenges. The more that they are more than 97 to 200, even though there was a time when they were at that level in terms of numbers, there were problems with regards to that. So it's an era that we would monitor coming down. One, we hold a view at the moment that we're far from monopolistic tendencies, which is where the Competition Commission, in fact, has to come in, which we have just signed a memorandum of understanding with it, because remember, it's a public entity itself. We are one as well, and therefore our arrangement will be looking into that. So that's how we will have to look into the question of the consolidation, whether a good thing or a bad thing. Do schemes have chronic benefits and hospices for cancer patients and chronic diseases and the rest of that? That's precisely the reason why we have got the PMBs, prescribed minimum benefits. What we have done with the PMBs, we've categorized of the many medical conditions. Diagnosis, if one wants to put it that way, 270 of such medical conditions, 25 chronic disease lists have been categorized as PMDs, which medical schemes must pay in full, irrespective of which benefit option a member belongs to. So once it is a chronic disease, it falls with and the 25 of them, like I said, or within those 270 that are listed, or any emergencies, it must be paid in full. So that is where then the question of the hospices and cancers and so on. I have to warn, though, when it comes to the cancers, that the cancers, different types of cancers require different types of treatments. And the different types of treatments that we're having, some of them are very recent, they are new, it's called biologicals, the new types of very recent, high, very expensive treatments. And yet, there are other treatment modalities that can still be applied for cancer, like the cancer of the breast cancer or the prostate cancer, prostate gland cancer, and so on, which do not necessarily have to go to the root of a Rolls Royce in terms of treatment because of the cost associated with that. But I do know that it's a very sensitive matter. I also know it's a very controversial because all cancers should ideally all be treated in full. There's a bit of a challenge with this payment in full as a concept, which we have been challenged on. But we keep on winning all of these cases. It is the fact that when you say payment in full, somebody considers that it doesn't matter what I charge, I'll be paid in full. And that means you're issuing a blank check for somebody to just grab the blank check, sign, and so that is where the specialists and private hospitals then come in. But for the purposes for which it was meant, which is to protect members in full, for this, that is why the payment in full in the PMBs and the PMBs have to remain in the statute book or in the regulation aid at least. Chairperson has dealt with the question of the acting chairperson, waiting for what the minister will have to make an appointment with regards to that. You acting people, like you have an acting senior manager and researcher with us in here, it's an operational matter. When in an institution you get certain crises and certain emergencies, people resign or people retire or people get expelled or whatever happens, they don't notify you in time to give you time, chairperson, to start putting matters in place as to what you do. So we would have normally in any kind of an operational matter, have people having to act while we're dealing with this. The principle is a simple one. And the principle is that there should be no gap, there should be no vacuum, the work that is done must continue, and extraordinary measures have to be in place and be applied. And that is why you've got a leadership in any organization to make such decisions. So it is in the context of that you normally have in operational matters people acting. 107 billion rand industry that we are regulating with only 107 million rand, Chief Financial Officer will elaborate on that because there are other models that he would cite that handle the question of the levies and how do you fund a regulation of any in industry so that we are not looked down upon, as we were mentioning, on the basis that we are small fries in a big pool where the industry is 107. It's a very powerful industry. 807. It has got deep managing it, and one of the reasons we're managing and we're succeeding is because the law and the act and us being a creature of statute is on our side. And this is why we rely a lot on the parliamentarians, we rely a lot on the ministry to support us as a regulator. And that makes us be able to take on this big giant, which is 107 billion. And continue to do so. We urge and we support. We really appreciate the support that you have given. 16% of the people in South Africa are on private health insurance, and the rest of 84% are not having rely on public health sector. And that is the initiatives of the, and that's where the whole debate about NHI comes in. The legal costs, and I think there's been mentioned that there's recovery with regards to that, and we continue to do so. The challenge is the fact that it takes a long time to have those legal costs recovered, but the process never stops. There's also an addition which is called appeals board.
Chairperson? Sorry, resident. You know, we thought we were going to finish at about 11, but what I want to make a request on, you are doing so well, and we wanted you to finish up yourself. And then those that you thought they were going to be answered by Oden, Notemuho, no Willy, we can get them as a written response. Yeah. So that we hit this one, we can see the members are leaving now. Some of the members are rushing for airport.
Hills Board is a ministerial board. It's equivalent of a tribunal. Typically, we should not be incurring the cost of running that board. Should be the ministry that does so. But we acknowledge the fact that there is an unconditional grant that comes from the ministry that has been referred to, that is found in the budget, and we, therefore you make use of that, because we cannot afford not to have an appeals board, which is a tribunal, when complaints have reached that stage, because the next stage after the appeals board is in fact high court with these complaints. And we have to make sure that each and every step of the way we are on board. The other aspect here is that I want to comment on the fact that really it's been money well spent for everybody to participate and present that. And I think that you can see we're trying to be very prudent and making use of the resources very efficiently. The chairperson dealt with it, but I'm going to ask Etebuho to deal with that just in detail again with regards the 24 rand per month per family. The rent and the renovations, then I'm sure he's going to really answer with regards to the rent, how we cannot buy with what premises that must be serving the membership and serving the public, and the agreements that would be in place, that list agreement that include that would pay the rental. Here are the conditions of us renting this place. We will, you as a master lord, as a landlord, will deal with these aspects, will deal with this, and therefore the renovations and maintenance would be speed according to the contract and the maintenance contract that we would be having. We would love to own a property of our own, but the council has guided us, the PFMA in particular, and Treasury have got certain guidelines that we must follow with regards to this. We'll continue and therefore on a list and renting the properties going on forward, even when we relocate from where we are. I think the question of the salaries, whether these salaries are part of the non-healthcare costs, is an important question. And it talks to what you mentioned earlier on, that we are a regulator of the medical aid schemes, and therefore the salaries and the benefits paid for the staff in the Council for Medical Schemes just falls like in a different category when you look into that. We've got a clear way on how we should generate our revenue. But in the industry and the entities that we regulate, there are guidelines of not more than this non-healthcare cost. Monitor them coming down. We mentioned we've got regular meetings, monitoring meetings with the schemes to monitor, amongst other things, that whether they are complying with this or not. I don't really know how the grant is coming in from the government. The history of that was that the Risk Equalization Fund was put to the Council for Medical Schemes to take care of and develop, and there was a grant that was dealt with that. After years of membership, then a person becomes old, and a person, what happens to such an individual, the question was raised, is that you cannot be kicked out from being a member of the medical aid scheme once you continue contributing. I guess the different types of options that an individual chooses to belong to a medical aid scheme is costed. There is a cost for a premium option as opposed to the low option, and therefore maybe with age and maybe with retirement the income drops, but if the benefits remain, they still cost the same. And that is a challenge, but you cannot be discriminated on the basis of that. It is expensive, and maybe then the person would fall off and get into the public sector. What we are guarding against is that the schemes must not offload an individual to a public sector purely on the basis that now there is a fallout gang or there is an arrangement, which is a PPP between the private sector and the public sector, and then it starts getting people off the private medical into the public sector, burdening and overburdening the public sector as it is. But the different options is an issue. I accept the fact that they become expensive for individuals as they get older and as they do not work and as they retire. I take the question with regards to the SCA, the RITAB, and ITAB, and all of these abbreviations. He's not here now. My apologies for that. We took it for granted. The board got carried away because we're so passionate about this kind of work that we do. Supreme Court of Appeal. I did mention the risk adjustment technical advisory panel. I tried to say so when I was making a presentation. But we should actually define our obligations, and I think it is a good advice that we're getting. The communication, we can't emphasize it more. I think its point has been made. We have a team. We have now chairperson have a fully fledged unit called Stakeholder Relations in the Council for Medical Schemes, precisely to address the question of education and training in all its forms and varieties, to beef up on the communication and customer care. It's a fully fledged unit now. All the years it has not been as fully fledged as it is. We hope, and this has taken place just over 2 months ago. So we took advice and we took counseling from the previous presentation that we had in this hall, because we have to do something about education and training, and we have done something about it. Give us an opportunity and a chance just to prove ourselves on it. I just really wanted to mention that. I talked about the cancer. Highlights of the council abbreviation, the rural areas penetration on schemes and understanding. Typically, you would get people who are on medical aid schemes being either well off or being employed. Typically, in the rural area situation is that breadwinner is working in an urban area and the rest of the family is remaining behind in the rural area. All of those people in the rural areas are covered in many instances by medical aid scheme because the family of this individual was working in the platinum mine in Marikana or any other mine industry. Those people out there are covered by the medical aid scheme. The question is whether it's good value for money for what they are getting because of this disjuncture in social stratification. Chairperson, it's a challenge, but I can say that those members, those beneficiaries that are in the rural areas have the same and equal access to health care in terms of the provision by the medical aid scheme. The challenge is, are the facilities there? Are the facilities, and in most instances, in fact, there are no facilities that are there. How do we then deal with this under the council, under the MSA Medical Schemes Act? That Medical Aid Schemes Act says make sure that there's no discrimination, make sure that there's equal access to this. It's a problem and a challenge beyond really our control, if I were to put it bluntly like that. But the principle has been established. Let's get the system, let's get the economy running, let's get the facilities, let's get the 5-kilometer range clinics, facilities and hospitals going on out there, and those poor people that are holding a medical aid card, but they cannot use it, at least they will have something and a place to go to. Well, what does the SCMS do after each HPC meeting? I've given a glimpse, Chair, to that. What do we do? And I've tried to indicate, at least with examples of some of the things that we do. Whom do you talk to? You have to talk to your medical aid scheme customer care division, its communication division, its complaints, dispute resolution. If you cannot get joy from dealing with your medical aid scheme, the lines at the Council for Medical Aid are open and people are allowed to do so in that appeals process that I've outlined that goes right up to the SCA. I know I'm repeating the SCA again. In this case is the Supreme Court of Appeals. That is the chain of complaints adjudication that we're having. And the education rent issue shows and a whole host of others, it is in really in our effort to reach as many people as we possibly can. Again, these rent issue shows are in Johannesburg, somewhere in Gunu or somewhere in Katlehong, or there is no such road shows. But if there were to be a conference in Durban or in here where we can be able to expose the work that we do, we will continue to do so. Amendment bill to the Act is we're dealing with that at the moment. In that amendment, Chairperson, you will realize if, from your own processes how an amendment to the Act is supposed to be done. The processes, it must go parliamentarize an officer, it must be on the roll, it must sit and then be debated by yourselves. We are on course on it as far as we are now concerned in dealing in with this. We have studied the process, we have given an input as to what the bill and amendment should be. And once that process, which we've got it clearly cut out, we know exactly what we do not know, is that once it comes out of our hands, as the Council for Medical Skills have given an input, what an ideal act should be, it will go to the next stage of the legislative process. It's beyond our stage when it comes to that. But we will monitor it, we'll give an input, we've already done, we're in contact with the ministry, and the deputy minister in particular is very keen to assist with the amendments to this Act, but we have to finish our processes. We are intending to finish our process by the 18th of November. From us, then we hand it over to the next level, from which then it will eventually end up with the parliamentary processes. So we are on course with regards to that. My colleagues will talk about page 60 and page 69 in the annual report where the tender processes and amounts and asset register update, which I wanted to confirm with the CFO that has been taken care of. The asset register is now currently in place. The office has got a tender committee that adjudicates. We do not want, and I don't think I should say this, Chair, in terms of saying when we relocate our offices, which we intend doing, we'll do it the proper way. We'll get the guidance on the PFMA. We'll get Treasury as we have done in right now, because we have seen and heard what happens when you are removing, when you are relocating offices of any institution. The council has given us a clear guideline that you have got to do this the correct way. The tender committee that we have and tender adjudication is in place within the office. You're not going to see what we have had happened before with public entities with regard to this. That's the commitment that the council is giving. That's the commitment that the registrar is giving. With that, without much time, I do want to give the CFO and my colleagues just to deal with the pressing issues that have been answered, that have been asked, and I think we have to do this. I do not think they will take too long.
The problem is that we've gone beyond the 12 o'clock, which was our deadline, but members, I think there are members who want to go and fly out of this place. So I'm not sure whether you could give us in written such a or you want to talk in 1 minute, the three of you. one minute, each one, if you want to say in 1 minute.
When we talk, Chair, we are very passionate. We'll take your time. It will suffice to provide you in writing. We've noted the questions. There are a lot of questions coming, the tenders issue, the renovations, the finances. We'll revert to you in writing, Chairperson, in the interest of time.
Thank you very much for helping me, because I don't want to see members of parliament tell you. I think it's enough if it happens in Marikana, not here in parliament. Then that calls on me to thank you very much for your report. There's no doubt about it that your report, we have accepted your annual report and we're going to put it forward. And I think you're one of the first that talks about unqualified audit report and cleanliness of the report, meaning that the performance. We're going to be quoting you time and again. and to those that we talk to. We'll talk to the ministry about the chairperson of the council. We'll definitely talk. Thank you very much. There's one thing that you have to say. Going there as the HIV and AIDS committee, and they say they need a
that we don't really understand the role of this commission. No, we don't call them back, but we discussed ourselves. Because I'm having a problem, Chairperson, we only have meetings when there is presentation. Because that day is a committee day. The chairperson and one member may not be around. Why the rest of us don't come and really teach each other about certain things? It will be the chairperson and the other person from the opposition. We are having a meeting today, but three members or four members from opposition are not here. But we are continuing. But my problem is we only have meeting when we have presentation, unless somebody tells me that that's the way it should be.